Pod. 22 Pod. How are you, mate? You alright?
Oh yeah, how are you? How you doing, man? You alright?
Yeah, not a bad, mate. How are you?
My first time on one of these things, man. I'm tired. I'm old school, you know. I'd rather sit in a pub and fucking talk to you. Yeah, so I don't know the best way to go about this. So I've got a couple of beers, a few spliffs, and we can have a chat.
Yeah, spot on, mate, yeah.
Nice.
You in Barcelona then, yeah?
Yeah, in Barcelona for now. Got a lot of work gaps at the moment. Go to England at the end of the month with Madness. So every weekend throughout the summer, I'll be going backwards and forwards.
Okay, cool, yeah. I think I saw you working the Albert Hall with them, was that right?
Yeah, that 2 days cancer trust, yeah, with Paul Weller. That was a really good one, yeah.
Ah, excellent, yeah.
Yeah.
So what took you out to Barcelona?
Well, I just love Barcelona. It's a socialist city, you know? So, you know, you've got the cannabis clubs, you've got all the... Everybody rallies against the system. It's not like England, you know what I mean? If there's a problem, somebody will... It's quite easy going and relaxed, and I just hate fucking England these days, so... And my work over the last 10 years with these, like with Billy Ocean and Madness, is like, it's 6 months work, basically, a chunk, but it's spread out the year. So I always get, you know, a lot of spare time off.
Okay.
So I didn't want to spend loads of money in London, you know, come to Barcelona on my spare time. But I moved here just before COVID, so locked down a month later. And it was a fucking hard lockdown here, so.
Yeah, I suppose it's the worst place to be locked down, though, I guess.
Yeah, exactly, yeah. Now everything's open, it's, you know, it's a bit of a mad city, you know.
So, take us back then, Jeff, like, what were you doing back in, say, like, the early 2000s? Like, how did you end up working with some of those bands?
Well, I would go to the 90s then, because I used to be, I was right in the middle of Britpop in London in the 90s. I used to go to the Wag Club. It's the mod club, and everybody used to be there, you know, David Auburn, all them lot, part of that scene. And I used to go to all the bands all every weekend to go see fucking Blur, you know, everybody has played at Brixton Academy then. With every weekend there'd be gigs, you know, I just could turn up at Brixton Academy or go to the Candom and stuff. And I was working as a mechanic, so I wanted to be in the music business after I've seen all these bands and been around that scene for like throughout the 90s. So the early 2000s I went and done a sound engineering course, and I wanted to be a sound engineer, so I was going around all the venues, you know, Barfly, watching all these new young bands coming up. And I was in the, where was it, ICA, Queen's Jubilee 2002. And that's where I first met Dominic Masters.
Right.
In there, and it's the Libertines were playing, and the 80s Matchbox Beeline Disaster.
Yeah.
I never really attracted attention to Libertines. I didn't really like them much, but it was like, it was the 80s Matchbox I went to see, and they was headlining that show. It was like an anti-Jubilee show at the ICA in right near Buckingham Palace, because they had, Buckingham Palace had the big party with, what's that geezer fucking?
Yeah.
Got a Queen on the roof. Yeah, so that was happening. And in just down the road on Pall Mall, we had the ICA with the Libertines and the 80s Matchbox causing havoc, you know, an anti-Jubilee thing.
Yes.
I think that, there's loads of footage, those wearing all their tunics and stuff, you know, back then days.
So it was like, obviously someone that was involved in Britpop, like, did you feel it was like an exciting time at that point?
Yeah, definitely. I mean, there was, you know, there was more working class people coming in to, you know, it's like punk again, you know what I mean? So before, I think Britpop more, you know, you had more art school people, like the 60s. But with the Libertines scene and the others and stuff, it was people coming, you know, they just wanted to be in a band. And they didn't give a fuck about if they could play properly or whatever, you know. So it was more like the punk ethics back in the 70s, you know, which I, you know, I'm 50. So I was seeing the punks, you know, well, I was eight when the 1976, well, I was five. So
Okay, all right.
Yeah, so I was a Sex Pistols fan at that age, you know what I mean? So I'd seen it all before from that, and I could see the similarities with, you know, the Libertines and stuff, and all them bands, and those fucking years, the exciting times, you know. There's always bands, you know, up in the bath, like Camden, I used to be quite a lot watching bands. But when I met Masters, Dominic Masters, he said to me that he'd just started a band. And then he invited me to go and see his guitarist, Jimmy. They was going to watch Ikara Cult at the 100 Club. Then I went and saw, I was hanging around with him, that he got his band going and stuff. And I was doing fucking everything for him, basically. And then, yeah.
What does everything involve then?
Well, basically, in them early days, I used to go around. I had a computer. I was on the internet in like 1999. So when I met Masters, what I really wanted to do, I wanted to be like Alan McGee and start a fucking record label with unsigned bands. You know, the compilations that he used to put out on Creation Records? I don't know if I've got any here. I've got all my stuff. We'd be a long interview this now. But Creation Records, they used to put compilations out with bands, like unsigned bands, or you'd put Alan McGee would put them into a studio and put them out. Like, so I used to go around trying to scout, you know, bands and say that I want to put a compilation album out. Do you mind? Then it'd give them publicity. And myself, you know what I mean? So you could go to a big label and get them signed or whatever, you know? It's like that sort of way of trying to do it. So do it yourself sort of thing. So, yeah, with the others, I mean, I used to do all their, when they started touring and got a record deal, I used to drive the van, set all the fucking back line up, find all the drugs for them. And what else did they used to do? But before that, when I was trying to get notice and stuff, I used to print out flyers and go around in the audience while they were playing, so everybody could, you know, put a link up to their blog spot or whatever it was back in the day. You know.
Yeah, I hear a lot about how, you know, the internet played a big role in bands like the Libertines and the others. You're obviously instrumental in that then.
Yeah, I mean, MySpace come up as well then, but it was like, you know, them days you could just get a CD, you know, you could print your own CD, get a disc making kit, get your labels, put them on there, do it yourself, you know. And that was, I did do a couple of the others' first demos as well on the CD. I mean, I've got this here, I don't know if you see, like that sort of thing. But,
Paddington's
first ever demo, that is, from the Paddington's.
That's what songs are on there.
It's got Headcase, Loser, Untitled, Blow. And Trying to Please, that's 21, that one.
21,
but it was called Trying to Please. And I don't know who their manager was then, Jonathan somebody. Jonathan, manager, yeah.
Excellent.
Yeah, it's all that sort of stuff. Things like, yeah, loads of other stuff as well. Must Play That One Day is the others at the Ribbon Factory, 2003. I recorded that from the sound desk onto an MP3.
Oh, nice one.
No, an MP3, a mini disc. Yeah, you know, so I have a mini disc and I asked the sound engineer if I could plug it into the board and record the gig. I got a Libertines one as well from the Rhythm Factory.
Oh, yes. You should get them on YouTube or something, yeah?
Yeah, I should do, really.
That'd be cool.
Yeah.
So, like, obviously, to put that work in for the band, you must have been pretty passionate about, you know, how good they were, kind of thing.
Yeah, I definitely saw Summit in the others. I mean, the first time I saw them, he didn't have the drummer. They had the drummer Martin afterwards, but they had a couple of drummers before. I think I might have missed their first ever gig. I think it was Hope and Anchor in London. But after that, I was at every single gig from like 2003 all the way to 2006. Never missed one gig. So
you obviously hear a lot about Dominic, and we've had him on here, but what was he kind of like to knock around with, kind of thing?
Yeah, he's, you know, he's like a brother to me, really, was back in the day, you know. But I didn't do the hard drugs he did, so, you know, I've nothing against Dominic. I haven't spoke to him for a good over 10 years, but I don't know, it's when, you know, I'll go back to that later on, but when, you know, 2005, more or less the band was commercially fucked, you know, because the interviews and stuff like that. So after that, I went and looked for other bands to work with. So I went and worked with The Automatic after that period.
Oh, yeah.
But, yeah, we can talk about that later if you want.
Yeah, yeah. I just remember Dominic saying, I think he preferred to knock around with you in his spare time in between gigs, like at Glastonbury and stuff, than with the band.
Yeah, all the time. I mean, I'd have to be with him. Well, I didn't have to be with him, but, well, I was his roadie, so I did, really. I mean, we went to New York, I was always with him. We went to Switzerland, Sweden, Japan, and, yeah, I mean, it's fucking chaos, really, when I think of it, because it's nothing like what I do now with Madness, you know what I mean? It's like quite a straightforward professional job. Then it was like I was sneaking in fucking all these young fans, because it, like, the venues had like age capacities on them. So places like Forum, we've done Kennistown Forum, but they're Apollo. Is it Apollo? Used to be the... Oh, fucking, I can't remember. No, the Astoria.
Oh, yeah.
On Oxford Street. They used to have the other club, the Astoria 2. So it used to have a club night called Fog. So the bands used to play there quite a lot. But that was obviously over 18s or whatever, and be fucking opening a fire exit to let all the young fans in from the libertines.org thing, you know. So all the young fans, and they used to be going up to the fucking dressing rooms and all that, you know. Then lose them in the audience afterwards, scatter, don't be seen, you know.
Yeah, it's like a lot of talk about that culture back in the day, that it was more kind of inclusive, like the band and the fans were kind of a lot more of a community kind of thing.
Yeah, definitely, yeah. I mean, I never used to be involved in house parties, but he used to live on Brick Lane, Dominic, and the man used to have, you know, hundreds of people back in a flat. I don't know how he got away with that. And same as Libertines, because I remember them used to, it'd be a Friday night or something, and he'd put a post on there, some guy in a cowboy hat or something would be waiting by a telephone box. You had to meet the guy at the telephone box, and they'd take you to a block of flats, and there'd be a like fucking little crack then there, people playing acoustic guitars, you know. And that was back in the day with that one.
Yeah, yeah. And just wanted to ask if you remember the story Dominic told about Ian Brown's brother at Glastonbury.
I remember, yeah, I do. I didn't meet him. I remember, yeah, we was hanging around with some guy who kept saying he was Ian Brown's cousin or brother or something.
Cousin, that sort of, yeah.
Yeah, but then when we done Tea in the Park, Ian Brown was in the dressing room opposite us, and he came over, so that was right. And he said, hey, what weed you got? And he goes, I said, I've only got a bit of hash. And he said, hey, give me some weed and stuff. And he was talking to Dominic there, and Snoop Dogg was in a fucking, he had a whole basketball court in the back. You ever been to Tea in the Park with the old Tea in the Park? And he used to have it was a really good festival, because he used to have an artist village. So all the bands and stuff would all be backstage. And yeah, he had a whole fucking bit cornered off, though, Snoop Dogg, with his basketball court. I didn't see what was going on there. I set up the equipment and I came back, and Ian Brown was there. And probably did see him.
Yeah,
I
yeah.
I can't remember the glass to me, really. A lot of drugs.
Dominic said something like he tried to run on the basket car and ended up getting escorted out or something.
Yeah, more likely did, actually, yeah. But he used to hang around with a guy called Alan Jules as well, who used to come on tour with us. Do you know Alan Jules? He was like he filmed that thing I sent you yesterday.
Oh, right, okay.
Channel 4, they gave him a Sony camera to film it. He was from Newcastle. He used to come down and take photos. He was a young kid who was trying to, you know, developing his own photos and stuff. He had a dark room and all that sort of stuff. So he probably got quite a good lot of pictures from you. The other's days, I reckon.
Oh, cool. Try and find them on Instagram or something.
Yeah.
So, like, yeah, you mentioned when the others get signed. Is that obviously a big deal for you as well as the band, the kind of thing?
Yeah, I mean, it's actually started getting, when I first started working, I was only getting 50 quid a day. And that was driving the van, fucking setting all the back line up, you know, going around, putting flyers in all the venues on the first tours outside of London. And yeah, but it's always fucking, it's weird because once they get signed, they think the person who's there at the beginning is not good enough to be their roadie. You know what I mean? So you always got some prick, they want to get some other guy in who's been working with fucking whatever, you know, some shit bands in the 70s or something. You know. But I stuck with it and they was loyal to me. So, you know, I learned on the job back then, you know. Learned to be a proper guitar tech in the back line and do drums and stuff. So,
yes, yeah. And like at what point, you mentioned the automatic later on, but were you just working for the others for those few years? Or did you start to work with some other bands as well?
Yeah, I've worked with the Paddingtons. I've done one show with the Paddingtons. Pete Doherty, supporter, Brixton Academy. I wrote some notes down actually about this. Yeah, the Pete Doherty support, but yeah, that was a fucking star-studded event, that was. Glenn Matlock was there backstage and Noel Gallagher come walking down the hallway as I was walking up the thing. Yeah, everybody was in that fucking, Bez was there, give me some stuff. Yeah, it was a real, you know, back then, they was right in the middle of the fashion thing, I think, the patterns, you know what I mean? The Christian Dior and all the, everybody wanted to dress them up, you know? And the first time I ever met the Paddingtons was in fucking place in Earl's Court. They was, I don't know if you remember what year this was, but Libertines were supposed to do Reading and Leeds Festival. But Pete Doherty left the band and went AWOL because he started Baby Shambles. But so on the Reading and Leeds, might have been 2003 actually. Need to check it out because I was still working as a mechanic then. So before I left my job full time. And there's a place called the Troubadour in Earl's Court, and it's like a tiny little bar with a downstairs little stage and stuff. Somebody said that Bob Dylan had played there or something in the 60s or whatever. But he started his Baby Shambles thing up, and he was doing two nights in there when Reading and Leeds Festival was on. And the Paddingtons was down there supporting it and with the others as well. And second night, I think Pete Doherty fucking run off through the kitchen halfway through the gig. I was watching it. There's all these rugby people in a really small place that was cool. And it's full of rugby fans. And I don't think he even knew who the band was, you know what I mean? They've been up in the bar upstairs. And so there's throwing beer everywhere. And all of a sudden, he's fucking, Pete Doherty was playing, and it's like a fucking electric shock. His water's gone on his guitar. He got electric shock and he run off straight through the kitchen, never came back halfway through the gig. I always remember that one because Tom was playing, they were singing. I was watching the Paddingtons for the first time and that 21 song. And I said to Tom after, but you're only fucking, look, about 16. He must have been only 17, and he's saying 21 and trying to please me, you know. Yeah. But great band, the Paddingtons. I was loving them all. Josh, what's happened to Josh?
He's in New York these days. I think he's got three kids now, yeah.
Three kids?
Just had another one, I think, yeah.
I ain't seen him for ages. He's a good lad, Josh.
Yeah, I was going to mention about the mad gigs. Obviously, if you're responsible for the sound, and like, there must have been a lot of occasions where, you know, fans would get on the stage and kick some out that you'd have to sort out, kind of thing.
Yeah, yeah, all the time. The stage invasion was, you know, he'd invite all the people up. I mean, I'd have to speak to all the, when the, we were doing places like Nottingham, Northampton Road Menders, whatever it's called. And all the, even the universities we used to do, university tours, which don't seem to happen anymore. And I'd have to speak to all the fucking security down the front and say, look, fans are going to come on stage. Just let them do it, you know what I mean? I control them when they're up here, you know what I mean? So I'd be there controlling all these kids, and some of the security would be okay with it. Sometimes they wouldn't. I mean, we had one place, I think that was Nottingham as well. Nottingham rescue rooms or something, and the security was getting all the fucking kids like this and bashing them through. And so grabbed hold of one security guard, and somebody else, one of the fans of the band, grabbed hold of one. There's a big fight and it's kicking off outside. But you know, if they stop the gig, if they stop people coming on stage or anything, they'd stop the gig. Dominic would, you know, and just sit there.
Yeah, I was watching I think you mentioned Japan, the festival they played in Japan.
Yeah,
and there's a bit where I think Dominic spots a kid getting chucked out, and he's like, that's all he's focused on before he plays another song, kind of thing. Yeah,
yeah, it didn't matter what sort of gig it'd be. He'd do that all the time. You know, one good thing, I suppose, is if that's what it's that band, no, there's no barrier between the band and fans. You know, it's a Clash ethic, isn't it? That's what the Clash said. So it didn't matter if it is a fucking, it could have been headlining the world, you know, you still stop a gig if anybody gets kicked out, you know, so, which is a good thing, you know. So.
We had someone called Ant. I think he used to call him Millwall Ant back in the day.
Oh, what?
He was saying about how Dominic stopped him, or the whole band, like, kind of stopped him going to prison at some point as well. He was like a big
fan. I heard bits about that. Yeah, I don't know. I used to see him hanging around backstage. I didn't like people. Yeah, well, that's when they were signed, and it was like, you know, they're fucking, this is like 2004-05, you know, they needed to keep going, because if they didn't sell records and get good press, they'd be gone after the first album, because that's what Mercury Records, they had a Mercury Record deal through Pop Tones. It was Alan McGee who signed them first on the Pop Tones. And then, you know, if they didn't play the ball, play the game and get all the fans and stuff after that first year or whatever, they wouldn't have a record deal after the second year. So it was, we're trying to keep it a bit more professional then. We had a tour manager on and stuff like that. But I don't know, people like that, like coming in the dressing rooms and stuff. I didn't like that, to be honest. You know.
Did the band kind of, or did Dominic rebel against that kind of corporate thing a bit or not?
Little bit, yeah, I think. I don't know, you have to just look at his interviews in the past, but it was always, fucking, I used to listen to him doing interviews while I was driving a van up the motorway and be in the back, and everybody used to have a BlackBerry phone. The manager gave him a BlackBerry, so everybody, anywhere we'd be going, obviously you get the radio stations or whatever phoning up and asking questions. And, you know, they try to label something, pigeonhole something. You know, trying to make out it's something he's not or whatever, you know, that's what they're trying to do, the press, you know, tying him in with other people. I mean, they definitely had, I think, the longevity of a band, the others, you know, if they had the right record deal and left to do what they wanted to do and had actually a decent wage, you know, but their wage wasn't amazing, I don't think. You know, it's still always that threat that, you know, still had to go to work or whatever, you know, it wasn't full time. People need to throw money at these bands, you know, otherwise you're never going to get anything unique anymore, you know?
Yeah, yeah. And did you say there was a point where you thought, yeah, this is probably going to go one way kind of thing?
About end of 2005, I think, was it had been really fucking busy. We'd been doing loads and loads of stuff, but it was like they was going to break and do their second album through 2006. So I went and looked for another work jobs, and I was going to be back with them again, the others, after I'd done the Automatic, because I was just with them through the summer. And where it started off through the first period of 2006. Then they lost the record deal with the others, and then they got signed to a label called Lime Records, who never fucking heard of. Could have been, I think the drummer sorted out a record deal just to put the second album out, which, yeah, you know, it's a good, strong album, but didn't really, there's nobody at the gigs. It was fucking, you know, from what it was the year before. And 2004 and 5, you know, everybody, it was really big gigs. Was blowing Kaiser Chiefs off the stage, fucking all these big gigs, you know, and like really good gigs. It was like Download Festival they'd done. Oh, how the hell they done get Download Festival? Yeah, on a Friday night, Download Festival. Garbage, I think, was headlining that stage. I don't know why they done fucking Download. Reading and Leeds, massive fucking crowds. Then just as soon as they broke up, you know, just stopped for a bit to do a second album. The press, you know, the NME was, I don't know, it's like really nasty paper at the time, back then times, so they could destroy a band's career, you know?
No, yeah, definitely. I remember them, it wasn't late on, it must have been like 2006-07 where they started caricaturing a lot of those bands, to kind of taking the piss out of them a bit, which
seemed
a bit harsh.
Well, there was that other band I think I heard on the podcast, one of your podcasts, 10,000 Things.
Yeah.
Sam Riley, who's a big actor now, isn't he? Like the guy who played Ian Curtis in Control.
Mm.
0 out of 10. I mean, it was fucking hell, you know. So there's no need for that. It shouldn't even be a music journalist, should you? If you're going to give somebody 0 out of 10, you've got to give a reason why you're going to give them. You give them something, you know what I mean? Because at least they produced something, and it was a fucking good album, you know.
Yeah, so that's the thing about it, is like it's not even a bad album. So
no, I've still got their t-shirt. It's 10,000 Things.
Yeah, you mentioned festivals. Like, just interested how that would differ from a normal gig for you. Like, was it easier, harder, or what kind of thing?
Harder, big, lot of pressure, because no sound check, and turn up and straight on the stage, pressure. Plus, with a band at that level, we'd be put amongst the people. I'd be amongst roadies who've been doing it since the 70s, you know. So they all always look down at other people, you know. I've always kept like that. Now I work with Madness, I always look after all the support bands as well, you know, look after their crew or whatever, and say, look, if you want to put your guitar rack here, if you want to put that there, because nobody would ever let me put anything. You know, we would just be treated like shit when we turned up at festivals, you know. So I'd have to fight the way through to, you know, to be able to get everything in order and stuff. And a lot of pressure on the festivals. I didn't like festivals. I mean, that Download festivals was a fucking nightmare as well. You know, because you got a massive stage and all we've been playing was pubs and clubs, you know. So you got to try and spread all the fucking, and it just didn't look like big stage like that with a small band like that. Didn't really, I mean, they had a good crowd there, but it wasn't, you know, one of the probably the worst gigs I ever done with them, actually, to be honest.
Fair enough. How did the crowd take it?
By the end, they did. It was pretty good. Not, you know, there was an audience there, but not massive. I feel a lot of emo kids there and stuff. I don't know why, who the hell would put them on. It was an emo tour. And after that, there's Jimmy Eat World.
Oh, yeah.
They was offered a tour with Jimmy Eat World. It was another emo band. So somebody was trying to put them into, you know, I don't know, some category of whatever.
Yeah.
You know.
So you're saying there weren't really much of a roadie community then? Is a bit hostile or what?
A bit hostile, yeah. Well, same as with the only other roadie I used to know was Shipman from the Cribs.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, you know, was he Shipman?
Shipper, yeah.
Because he started the same time as me. He was doing everything for the Cribs and driving the van, that Riot van they had. So I used to hire a van from a place called Tiger Tours. And we'd done our first tour with the others outside of England, outside of London, was with the Cribs. It was a Cribs headline tour, I think, but it was more of a double headline. So, and the others was doing, I fucking got all the flyers here. Little Civic, Wolves, the Cribs. It's 2004, so the Cribs, 1st of May, Liverpool Academy. I think that was the first, that one. Let's see.
Oh, yes.
But this is that was the first gig, I think, outside of London with the Cribs. That was the first of the 504. So, yeah, Cribs, fucking great band. Good bunch of twins, or triplets, whatever. They ain't twins, are they?
Two of them are, yeah.
Two are twins, yeah.
Yeah. Thanks for listening to this episode of 22 Grand Pod. If Naughty's guitar music is your thing, then you might enjoy our Patreon page, where for £3 a month you will get access to the following series. The Naughty's Deep Dive, where we go through the likes of the Stalking Pete Doherty documentary in painful detail. My favourite 2000s album, where patrons and other guests come on to talk about their favourite album of the era. Legend or Landfill, in which we go through Enemy's top 10 albums of each year from 2001 and see if we think they are indeed legendary or for the landfill. Unsigned Stories, where we chat to bands that didn't quite make it in terms of signing that elusive record deal. We also have Fan Stories, where I talk to people about their memories and opinions on all things Naughty's Indie. You also get early access to any main podcast episodes, and it's also worth checking out the YouTube page, where you can see extended video versions of the interviews, as well as plenty of other bits of commentary and opinion. All links are in the description. Now back to the pod. Yeah, what's it like going around the country then? Did you have like favourite places to play, like, or favourite place to work for you kind of thing?
Liverpool was always good. But a lot of miles. I mean, that first, I was speaking to, I don't know if you know, Agent Blue. It used to be a band called Agent Blue.
Not sure, no.
And they used to support the Others a lot. So it was that tour, it was the Others, Paddington's and Agent Blue. They were from Stoke. And fuck it, I was speaking to the guy the other day, the drummer from that band, and he said, I did, because I was trying to refresh my memory, and he said, we've done 120 dates. So wow. I'd been driving. I remember driving all the way from Hull to Taunton, then Taunton to fucking Glasgow the next day. You know, that is, the schedule was like all over the place. And like, I remember putting about, must have put about 10,000 miles on this van what we hired.
It was always your job
to
drive.
Just me driving all the time.
Yeah. Is that a bit of a ball ache?
No, nah, that's fucking horrible. Horrible for me. It was. The tour manager who'd done the sound engineering, he wasn't really he was a tour manager, but he's more of a sound engineer. And ex-army said he, for fucking 4 years, said he couldn't drive. All the time I work with him, I'll put this in here now because it's always stuck in my mind, you know what I mean? 4 years working with the Others with him, sitting next to me while I was driving all over the fucking country, no sleep, up all night, then driving again. I left him after the Others. I saw him driving a fucking van to another band right afterwards.
That's tight,
so, you know, he could drive, you know, he just didn't want to drive.
I remember one of my memories of the Others back in the day is when they played and the NME Awards are going on and they were playing in a pub around the corner. I don't know if you're involved in that way.
Yeah, yeah. I took all the equipment up there in my Volkswagen Scirocco.
Right.
Yeah, it's basically, it's next door, and it was a setup basically. That, I mean, to be honest with you, the NME Awards was in the Hammersmith Palais, and they're right next to the Hammersmith Palais, which is shut down now. It's a fire station or something, might know, or fucking restaurant or something. But next to there is a pub, and it was in there, so they had to pretend they were doing a griller gig in the pub.
That was it, yeah.
And then they came in and give them the award for the most innovative, I don't know, what do they win an award for?
Innovative,
most,
don't know.
Yeah, innovative, most innovative band or whatever.
Okay, all right.
Yeah.
Then you see when he goes to work with the Automatic, was that a bit more, I don't know, chilled out? Oh, how was it?
Well, that was a fucking year of debauchery, to be honest.
Fair play.
I got after 2005, I got a call from the guy who I used to rent the van off for the Others, Tiger Tours, a guy called, I can't remember, I know his name, but I can't remember. He said, oh, it's a band, a new Welsh band, they want a driver and a backline tech. I said, okay. So he called me up and they come and pick me up. They was already doing little bits and pieces. They weren't that famous or nothing by that time. And there's doing all these university tours for some reason. So they picked me up with my house and I had to drive them around. But that time the guy was sharing driving, so it was pretty good. But straight away, after 2 weeks, they wanted to keep me and they went straight on a tour bus. So I didn't have to drive anymore.
Oh, nice one.
So the whole of that year, I'm on a tour bus for the first time of a band and obviously fucking, yeah, it's a party, you know? So, And they were just that band there that was throughout that whole year. It was just money being thrown at them, and they had that song Monster.
Yeah.
And that went number four in the charts, and it was like, it was fucking, you know, full on good.
Yeah, yeah. I remember seeing them at, me and my mate just went to see them one night randomly at a pub in Sunderland. I don't know, you might have been there. 2006, I think.
Yeah, I'd have been there, yeah. Tiny pub, yeah. I remember I was with Rowlands around the side.
It was tiny, yeah.
Yeah, yeah. I don't know why I was doing that one. Is that part of the inner city thing or something? They used to have that thing, didn't they, up in Newcastle along the river?
Right. It was one of those where, go on. I just remember seeing it in those NME listings and just going along that for the night.
Because the others done it. That was a fucking other great gig from the others. And it's in Newcastle, but it was like along the river. And they had a stage there, and we was on stage with Mick Jones from the Clash's band, whatever he had at the time, Magna or something, was it? Magnet or something.
Right.
So he was, Carbon Silicon. I think he was Carbon Silicon, Mick Jones. So he was on the same stage. I think he was on before the others. And it's fucking mad. If anybody had any footage of that, because the whole of the riverbank, I could see it was fucking people, loads and loads of people. It was a bank holiday weekend. I can't remember the name of the festival, but that was Newcastle's always a great place. And I, you know.
Yeah, but yeah, there's a few of those things, weren't it? Like Camden Crawl and that, were they quite exciting? Exciting festivals to do, yeah.
Camden Crawl.
Were they a bit easier than the average festival kind of thing?
Well, the Camden Crawl was like, I suppose they were, because they weren't, it's like, they weren't really professional. Most of the, you know, the small gigs, you could turn up and just throw your gear on stage, as long as you get a good sound, your amps are set up and stuff, and you get a good sound. Nobody expecting world-class sound and fucking amazing, you know, not like when you get to a big stage, you know, like, if you get to a big stage, like Download Festival or something like that, or headline stage, Glastonbury, you need a sound check, you know, otherwise you're just going to, halfway through, nobody's going to enjoy it. You know, the band don't enjoy it. The audience don't enjoy it. So and none of the crew enjoy it, because the sound engineer definitely don't enjoy it, because he's trying to fight with the sound for half the gig. Then by the time he's got it right, the gig's over.
Yeah. Oh, you know, that video you sent me with all the rain and that, was that a bit of a nightmare for you?
That was fucking awful, that one. Yeah, because the night before we supported Psychedelic Furs.
Oh, yeah.
Why the fuck? that's where that gig footage is from. And Psychedelic Furs in the Shepherd's Bush Empire, just as a warm-up. So we drove straight after there to a hotel outside of Glastonbury. And it rained all fucking night. And it was, we didn't know the gig was going to go on. But they'd already done it the year before, though, the others. They'd done Glastonbury twice. They'd done it in 2004, and they'd done the John Peel stage. And that one was, they was going to be doing the other stage. Yeah, we got there, and it was fucking, you couldn't even get to the stage. It was like people in dinghies and stuff trying to get over to. Then it happened, done it. It was a good gig.
Yeah, fair, yeah.
Yeah.
Are you able to enjoy festivals like that then? Are you thinking, oh, we need to be off tomorrow kind of thing?
Yeah, that Glastonbury, I think we had a couple of days off after that. So we did party all night in Glastonbury. We went to the Lost Vagueness and all that sort of tents and sat up and done the usual shit, sit up on the hill at 6 o'clock in the morning.
Yeah.
And
was that the best one you went to?
No, I prefer going aboard myself. I prefer, yeah. Japan was the best times with the others. Really great. Because they done Osaka and Tokyo. But that is mad, that footage there. It was a baseball stadium or something. And it was like 12 o'clock in the daytime they was playing. One of the second bands on or something. And fucking absolutely real hundreds of thousands of people. Yeah.
Must be surreal when you're over there, yeah.
It's pretty shit on there. I mean, Dominic never used to get on with any of the rest of the other bands. So I remember being in Japan and the Preston from the Ordinary Boys come up to me. He thought I was in the band. And he said, can you tell your singer to stop talking shit about me in the press? I went, well, I didn't know who he was. And he said, oh, I don't know. So I don't know what happened there either. So, and I was playing football with the Lars, because the Lars has reformed. for a bit back then. I was, Lee Mathers was playing football backstage, and that was, yeah, because I was on early, so that one of the first band, that's the best thing with the others. If I'd worked with Madness doing them gigs, I've got to sit around all day in a hotel, don't see anybody. But there, my work's done at 1 o'clock in the afternoon, so you can sit around the backstage and meet all these other people. And so we was hanging around with Kasabian a lot back then. I used to know Tom quite well. I saw him actually in Brighton not longer, 5 years ago. Yeah, but I was playing football with the Lars, and Liam Gallagher come, because the headline was Oasis on that, them Japan gigs. And he thought I was a fucking drummer in the band. I said, well, unless I've lost about fucking 20 stone, you know. So, he was starstruck to see Lee Mathers. He didn't even speak to Lee Mathers. I was playing football with Lee Mathers. And, but Liam, he had his own, you know, bless him, man. He's like, he had his own fucking dressing room, two dressing rooms, like where we were just in there doing his vocal warms up. So, yeah. But I've done Oasis tours before. Well, through the others, when I was working with the others, that guy I was speaking to you about, Alan Jules from Newcastle, his mates, a band called The Lull, they were supporting Oasis in Newcastle for 2 days in 2005. And they wanted a guitar tech, you know, somebody to set their stage up to make them look professional stuff on this Oasis, two Oasis gigs. The reason they got the gig is because the singer's sister was babysitting Liam Gallagher's kid for some reason, Patsy Kensett's, Lennon at the time. So they was the Lull, yeah. So I've done two gigs with them, and that's, you know, we was invited to the catering with Oasis and all that back then. So we're sitting there with Noel Gallagher and stuff, eating our fried eggs.
Yes, well, they're pretty friendly kind of thing.
Yeah, so welcoming, great. You know, even the others done a tour. Austria was doing a festival in Austria, and Oasis headlining then as well. And they had the dressing room right next door. Me and Jimmy Lager went in and spoke to Noel and Gem Archer. Liam, you never see Liam at gigs. You know, he's in and out, you know.
Must be cool being able to watch a band that size from like the side of the stage or whatever as well.
Yeah. It's fucking great. I saw him. Liam was doing with Madness a few years ago at Benicassim down the road here in Barcelona. Doing it at Madness, and Liam was headlining that. And I went and stood after Madness had done their set. And fucking loud, man. He's like, he's got five monitors. And it's like, yeah, but fucking, yeah, really good. Yeah. I'd love to work with Oasis or Liam Gallagher, but I don't know. There's always that clicky crew, you know, it's hard to get into them sort of circles. As either you got to be from Manchester or you got to be from Liverpool or something, you know. Luckily, I'm from London, so I can work with a London band.
Yeah.
So they get me.
Is that what it's like a bit being in your position? It's all about who you know rather than it's no qualifications kind of thing.
No, not really. You got to know what you're doing. You obviously got to be switched on. You got to be connected with who you're working with. And like, you know, you got to be in the vibe, especially if you're doing small gigs where it's chaos and there's guitars being thrown around everywhere. You got to be on the ball yourself. You can't be out of your head. Yeah, I never used to do any drugs with the others at all. You know, or never drunk before gigs or anything like that. You always keep it professional. That's for my work ethic as being a mechanic, you know what I mean? So you get everything laid out, you've got to be gelled, and everything's got to be, you know, fucking glued together. Otherwise, you know, some roadies, they don't even want to put a beer out for a band member, you know. But if somebody's, that's what they do, you've got to fucking open his beer for him, you know. You're part of, for that 1 hour or half an hour gig, you're part of what's going on that stage, you know?
Yeah. You've got
to be aware of what's going on.
Have you had to deal with like a lot of big egos or not really kind of thing?
Oh, God, some other bands. I was trying to find out what's on my list of bands, actually. Because as you say, the indie landfill after 2006, I was getting offered a lot of shit. No, there's a band called the Red Light Company. They were rubbish. the worst ego I ever had. I'll tell you one band I worked for. No, a band called The Modern. They employed me after this back in, this is my, I still work with the others, I think, but I think it was in a studio. So I got offered some driving and backline for this band, The Modern. And the singer was, she played a young Pat Butcher in an EastEnders spin-off.
Right.
I don't know. Anyway, fucking awful band, man. We turned up these gigs. I was like, done a gig in Hull, actually. They're not Hull, near Hull. That other place that starts with H up there.
Harrogate?
No, a really rough place. Might be not Harrogate.
No, definitely not Harrogate then.
Can't remember. I know it's fucking anyway. But anyway, nobody there at the gigs. Like literally five people with my ego on them. It's insane. I left after 2 days. I said to the tour manager guy, I said, I can't work with these anymore. I said, if they played Duran Duran in the fucking tour, in the van, one minute longer, I'm going to fucking drive the van into the fucking centre of Edinburgh. They want to listen to it, Duran Duran and shit like that. But yeah, that was an ego and a half. But,
right. Yeah, from judging from what people have said on here, like, it's often the case that the bigger the band, sometimes the smaller the ego and like vice versa.
Yeah, I mean, you know, madness, no egos whatsoever, real down to earth people. I imagine the personalities are basically the same, more or less, as they, I would say, when they first started, you know, they still got that work ethic. I mean, the problem is, it's the rich kids, isn't it? That's what Dominic has a problem with as well. They're the ones with the ego because they've been given everything, you know what I mean? They're privileged. So, you know, they think they can. I mean, I've been treated like shit by fucking band members. You know, they just treat their, if you come on to do their guitars and stuff, they look down at you, you know, some people. So, you know, I've had that before.
So just going back then, you're working with the Automatic, like at what point, I don't know, like what did he do from that point? When did that finish?
That finished the October of 2006. That's when I went and done the others, went on their second album tour. But the Automatic, I mean, that was fucking, you know, we'd been going away. We went to Japan again. I went to Japan again. So with them, so I've been there the year before that I went with them to do the other festival, Fuji Rock Festival. It's just fucking crazy. I mean, they had a manager, the Automatic, they had this manager who had really never managed bands before either. So he was full on rock and roll as well and up to all sorts of the, it all went a bit weird. And I used to look after Penny, the keyboard player, and the drum. I used to be drum tech and keyboard tech and look after the keyboard player, Penny, the little shouty guy.
Yeah, I remember that. Yeah,
I got that job because they said, oh, you've been looking after Dominic and he's very difficult, we've heard. So we've got a very difficult guy called Penny in this band. Can you look after him and do the drums? So yeah. So.
All right. What, was he difficult?
Nah, he's a good lad, Penny. I mean, these days he's covered in fucking tattoos everywhere, head top to toe. No, he was a good lad. You know, it's like, yeah, a good band, the Automatic. But don't know what happened to him really. To be honest. After that, I didn't do anything else. So went back with the others in 2006. After the others, and that was that. I think 2007, I moved to Spain again. I was in Spain for a year. But I'd worked with them, I started working with them new wave fucking rock and roll bands like the Klaxon thing, Sunshine Underground. I was working with from Leeds. So I don't know why I was getting loads of offers from bands from Sheffield and Leeds all the time.
So work was like quite consistent from the Automatic onwards kind of thing.
Yeah, every year I've always had something. Then I started getting into the, what they say, the big league, which is the old. Yeah, people have made the big money, you know, in the 80s and stuff. Billy Ocean I worked with. And I'd had enough of rock and roll by the end of the Pigeon Detectives. I've been doing the Pigeon Detectives for a bit. Then I got offered Billy Ocean, and I was doing theatres and going all over the world in these weird exotic fucking locations, being treated in 5-star hotels for 5 years.
You're thinking you've made it at that point, kind of thing.
Yeah, I think it's a proper job then. You're getting proper money, you know. Getting fucking 6 times more than I was getting with the others. Stuff, you know?
Yeah.
And it's, you know, it's a proper job then. And you've got to, it's what the rest of your way of life. And this, before it was always difficult to think, oh, is this going to be my way of life or not? But once you've got a good band and they trust you and you're loyal, you know, you can plan, you know, everything out.
So at what point did you start working with Madness?
2012, 10 years this year. Yeah, I was working with, I got offered with them. I was working with Billy Ocean and I was in America with Billy Ocean. And the tour manager phoned me up for Madness. He said, oh, I've got this gig for you. You know, an ideal gig for you. It'd be a long-term thing. I said, well, I'm happy really with Billy Ocean stuff. But then I said, oh, fucking yeah, I'll do it. So I'm doing both. I was doing Billy Ocean and Madness. And then I decided I prefer Madness, you know, my job, because I on Billy Ocean, I was stage manager, keyboard tech. I mean, I'm not really a keyboard tech, you know what I mean? I can't program shit, you know, and stuff. But yeah, I've done a good job for him for 5 years, set the keyboards up. I was doing guitars on there as well. Tour managing when we was in America. And it's fucking, but the Billy Ocean thing, it was always a lot of travel because he's obviously been big in America, you know, and I'm not really a big fan of America. I don't like going to America. And with Madness, I don't really go to America very often, which is, you know, good, fine by me, really. I'd like to go to South America. I've never been to a South America yet, but yeah, so I was doing two bands, and I just said, I'll just do Madness now. I left Billy Ocean.
So you can just do Madness now, and then that's you sorted, kind of thing?
Not really, to be honest, but it gets me by. The last 2 years has been a fucking bit worrying, to be honest, you know, because I moved here. What we're doing this year is what I was supposed to be doing 2 years ago. Because I moved here in January 2020, and we had whole festivals, you know, Spain, Europe, everything booked. We haven't been able to do any. So now we're doing all that. So I've had to wait 2 years really to, you know, luckily I got a bit of money from the government, but that was it, just to get us by, you know.
Is there anything you would do differently about back in the day, or is it kind of that's got you to where you are now, kind of thing?
I think I would have preferred just before I met the others, right? This is what I was doing. I was going to Notting Hill Arts Club a lot, you know, the Death Disco. And I used to know the sound engineer there, Chris, a guy called Chris Brothers. And he's a big sound engineer now. He works for bands like Skunk and Nancy and stuff like that. And but in the Death Disco would be just like a little tiny mixing desk, you know, 8-track mixing desk. And when I'm down there, this is another thing about the Gallagher thing as well. Paul Gallagher, I was friends with Paul Gallagher because he used to be in the Notting Hill Arts Club, and he had all these bands he was trying to put on. He had a band called International One, Cornerstones, and he said to me, he goes, oh, you seem to know about music and stuff. Can you mix the sound for the, not being funny, but the Notting Hill Arts Club was fucking tiny, you know, small place. And can you mix the sound? Just want to hear is acoustic band like, you know, Cornerstones. It was a bit like the Lars sort of thing. And can you just guide the sound engineer and fucking get the sound right? So, because it's industry showcase gig. So, you know, I've done that for him a couple of times, Paul Gallagher. And then I've done a sound engineering course in Notting Hill, and I had to cut it off. I'd only done 6 months of it because the others went on tour.
Oh, okay.
That was a free. So that's what I wanted to really do. I wanted to be a monitor engineer. You know, I didn't want to be front of the house. I wanted to be monitors on stage, looking after the band. But now I do it with guitars, and like, I do it really well. I make my own guitars and, you know, self-taught and know what I'm doing. So.
Yes. Yeah, that's that really, mate. I don't think I've got anything else, but Thanks again, that was spot on.
Yeah, anything else? I mean, I don't know what else there is. No, I think that's it. I mean, unless you want to go into the new wave tours and all that sort of stuff, Klaxons and Sunshine Underground.
Well, yeah, how did that compare for you then? Were you into any of that?
That was a weird one, because the Automatic, well, I stayed with the Automatic, they'd done the rock tour, but I went and done a new wave tour, the NME new wave tour, and that was with the Sunshine Underground, and it was Sunshine Underground, New Young Pony Club, CSS from Brazil, and the Klaxons. Yeah, so soon as I went in there, the first day, I thought, fuck it out. You know, I've been around a bit and I see these kids doing, all of a sudden, everybody's doing ecstasy. It was again like 1990s again. I'd just come out of a scene, everybody's doing fucking crack and cocaine and speed. And like, all of a sudden, you go into the Klaxons thing and everybody's doing all the fucking dance drugs. So that was definitely another scene going on, yeah. But what else was that? Then Pigeon Detective, Little Man Tate, great band. I'm doing tram lines with Little Man Tate this year.
Oh, okay.
Because Madness are playing on the Sunday and Little Man Tate have reformed and they're doing it on the Saturday. So.
I bet bands reforming is probably good news for you as well, isn't it?
Yeah, well, definitely, yeah. I mean, I'm waiting for the 80s Matchbox Beeline Disaster to fucking do something. I think,
yeah,
that was crazy days working with them as well.
Yeah, did you say it was Sim that told you about the podcast?
Yeah, he kept mentioning me in other podcasts. I used to speak to Jeff Catani, but nobody's. I don't like to me, I'm old school. I'd rather fucking put a book out, you know.
Yeah, have you ever thought about that?
Well, that's what I was, yeah, but I couldn't write it myself. I'd need a shadow writer, but,
all right,
you know, one day, hopefully. I did work with Bill Wyman as well.
Okay.
Rolling Stones. But that is another thing. After fucking Pigeon Detectives and Little Man Tate, I'm getting offered all these old timers. But in like 2010 onwards, there was no new bands really. It was all old bands. So all the roadies when I worked with, you know, that's where the work was, you know, to be working professionally, you got to work with bands who already got the money from the 80s, you know. Or the 90s or 70s or 60s even. So yeah, Bill Wyman and the Rhythm Kings, I was looking after him for a bit. I've done two European tours with Bill Wyman. And that was
nice.
Just one thing, actually, for that trip to France with the Paddingtons.
Oh yeah, go on, yeah.
Yeah, that was, I was on that obviously. And that video you put on, if you put up 3 minutes on that video backstage, you'll see a guy wrestling Lloyd.
Right.
With a plant pot. And that's that's Steve Hussey. He was tour manager. That Stevie Hussey used to be the drummer in These Animal Men. Now, These Animal Men was managed by the others' manager.
Okay.
So he started doing tour managing. I worked with him as well, way through with Billy Ocean. He was drum tech on Billy Ocean. But yeah, he tour managed that trip because we had a sleeper bus and with both of us on the others and the Paddingtons on that bus. And I always thought that Heidi Salone was a woman, because Heidi, you think is like, but I thought it was like a fashion show, but Kate Moss was there and all that stuff. Yeah, it's a fucking mad one. And yeah. Pet Shop Boys and stuff.
Yeah.
All the stories, yeah, I said it was all there. I kicked him off the bus.
You kicked him off the bus?
The Pet Shop Boys.
All right.
So we didn't want them on their bus but at the time.
Yeah, I mean, it looks fascinating, that video, like what was going on, and that must have been quite exciting to be around.
Yeah, it's a fucking mad party, because I remember I was underneath a piano on stage because Pete Doherty came on and sung with the Paddingtons, and I was back doing teching for both of the bands, and I was looking after the stage for both. And for every gig, anyway, I used to be crawling on the floor because cables and stuff would be pulled out of amps and stuff. So, you know, so not to be seen, I'd be under the fucking, you know, laying on the floor. And Pete Doherty was there, fucking kicking over all the amps and stuff, I remember. And then I looked around, Kate Moss was there, yeah. And mad. All that fashion people started coming in. It was like, you know, copying what Tom and everybody else had got from a charity shop.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, the Macs and stuff. I remember the first time I ever saw Tom, I was like, you know, it's all, you know, sharp dressed, but with no money, you know. Fucking good way, yeah. Good way to do it. Then all of a sudden you get everybody, all the fashion designers wanting to rip them off.
Then you helped me out. You gave me a break from the boredom. Quit my job, I took a gamble on a new life.